I'm John Schumann, and this is Medical Matters, a limited series produced at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Today on the program, we try to understand why healthcare in America is so much more expensive than in other industrialized countries. Our guest, journalist Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times, has published a multi-part series called Paying Till It Hurts, in which she explores the medical industry's mysterious billing practices, hospital charges, and why the same medication costs more in the U.S. than it does elsewhere. The series has won several awards and has inspired a Facebook group to let readers share their stories and further the conversations. Rosenthal was trained as a physician and worked in emergency medicine before switching full-time to journalism in 1994. Also on the program, Gary Schweitzer is here to review health news, and recent Harvard Med School graduate Sherry Yerkowitz reads her viral essay, Post-Operative Check. First, this hour's news. I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. Today on the program, the opaque and expensive world of healthcare costs in America. We talk with reporter Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times about her award-winning series, Paying Till It Hurts. But first, with his weekly review of all the health news, both fit for print and otherwise, is Gary Schweitzer on the line from his home office in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Gary. How was your summer?
Terrific.
Great. Well, I really had to ask you, there was a story this summer that got a word we don't often hear into the news media cycle. Journalists jumping at the chance to say the slang name for flatulence?
I think it's safe to say that the chance for journalists to say fart in a story led to, depending on what day you look on Google, what I now have found anywhere from 300,000 to 600,000 returns on a simple web search when you use the search terms farts and cancer. Here's how it happened. And as I wrote about this, it's kind of like the old game of telephone. You know, you communicate a message from person to person to person, and you see how the message disintegrates as it passes on. Well, this started with a basic research paper, the most basic kind of science, in a journal that journalists never look at called Medicinal Chemistry Communications. But there was also a news release from the university where the research was based, the University of Exeter in the UK. And so here was the title of the paper: The Synthesis and Functional Evaluation of a Mitochondria-Targeted Hydrogen Sulfide Donor. Now, does that sound like something's going to get 600,000 returns? But the news release said, it, hydrogen sulfide, may smell of flatulence, but it may offer potential health benefits from diabetes to stroke, heart attacks, and dementia. So what do you think we got? We got news stories like this. UPI, United Press International. Scientists say sniffing farts could prevent cancer. The New York Daily News, fart gas may help prevent dementia, heart disease. And then a radio station in L.A. saying, pull my finger, this fart might cure cancer. John, this was, as I said, the most basic of basic research. And it's one of these classic examples of a news release misleading journalists, and journalists, clearly, there was no evidence that any of these stories took the time to look at the article itself. And if they had done that, if they could get by that long title that I just gave you, they would have seen that what they were saying as statements of fact, farts could prevent cancer, dementia, heart disease, was absolutely ridiculous.
It really stinks, doesn't it?
It does. Now, the good news is Time, which had said, ridiculous study of the day says smelling farts might prevent cancer. After we criticized them, and perhaps as a result of our criticism, 3 days later, they posted a correction saying an earlier version of this article incorrectly summarized the findings and implications of this study. So, you know, for your listeners, I would just make the point. I mean, I do this full time, but when you see stuff like this, you have to let the journalists know that they're wrong and that you're bothered by it, and maybe we can all affect some results.
Okay, you mentioned Time magazine. They had a cover story this summer about manopause. What is manopause?
Low T, low testosterone, about which the evidence is very weak, and I raise the question, is this really worth one of the 52 weekly Time magazine covers that are going to be published this year. And while there were some caveats in the story, still the amount of attention and the amount of attention that was given to a guy who runs a low testosterone clinic was way out of whack. So again, I would say caveat emptor to your listeners, let the buyer beware. But you know, there was some good stuff we should talk about. Anyone this summer who had a pulse would have heard about the ice bucket challenge.
This is where people were challenging their friends on Facebook to pour ice water over their head to raise money for research against ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
That's correct. Yep. And I caught a story in the Cincinnati Inquirer, which was short. I didn't do a word count. Probably was 100, 150 words. Succinct, effective. It was non-judgmental. It didn't say what was right or wrong about the campaign. It simply stated facts. And some of the facts were these, that the ALS Association pays its management $1.7 million in annual salaries. They spend $1.2 million a year for travel. They spend $3 million since 2009 to lobby legislators, and they paid out $6.6 million in grants. So you start to add some of that up, and the headline of the story was, Ice Bucket Challenge, well, here's where your money goes. And as I said, non-judgmental, I basically just read you the entire story, and it simply pointed to the facts as reported by that association. So I really think as we get caught up in some of these viral, often social media-driven campaigns, it doesn't hurt to step back and say, wait a minute, where's this money going? How's it being spent?
Along the lines of viral stories, there was a news item this summer about a new medication presented in the European cardiology meetings. Tell us the story there.
Well, two big issues. That's a big meeting held in Barcelona, the European Society of Cardiology. And so one of the stories that caught my eye was about heart attack and stroke, and the other was about heart failure. So the heart attack and stroke, for example, got the attention of the New York Times with a headline, cholesterol drug halves, cuts in half, heart attack and stroke in an early test. Another story that I saw said, magic cholesterol pill halves heart attack risk. So that's the bad news part of this. The good news part is really a reflection on what high-quality bloggers in this country can do to set the record straight. And one of the best is a doctor from Yale, Dr. Harlan Krumholz, who tweeted, that New York Times headline sends the wrong message. Oh my, so wrong. This is not proof of efficacy. Remember, the New York Times said this cuts the heart attack and stroke risk in half. And Larry Houston, who is a journalist who publishes a blog called Cardio Brief, said right up front in his second sentence, this trial was neither designed nor powered to study outcomes, so it should be considered preliminary and speculative at best. God love bloggers at times like that in setting the record straight. So that was on the heart attack news. Out of that same meeting, much bigger news came out about a heart failure drug, and journalists used words like game changer, remarkable, breakthrough, most exciting ever. And indeed, it may turn out to be that, but for now, once again, Dr. Harlan Krumholz, who blogs on Forbes.com, had a column, Three Questions That Remain After Novartis, the drug company's blockbuster trial result. And he asked really simply three things. First, will this drug benefit patients with heart failure who are unlike the patients who were in the trial? Important question. Second, if and when this drug is approved, how will patients and doctors decide to give it a try? So in other words, what's the real-world impact and setting? And third, will the sponsor, Novartis, share the raw data so that others can carefully assess the findings? And to that point, he wrote that this research, the sponsor, Novartis, collected, managed, and analyzed the data. And so we didn't see that kind of skepticism or analysis in a lot of the stories. And I thought that that was really important. A blogger who I just think is tops. He's the cream of the crop. He's from the UK. He's an old general practitioner. Richard Layman wrote, "This has been hyped as the biggest breakthrough in heart failure for at least 20 years, but this trial is a perfect example of everything that is wrong with heart failure trials."
Well, Gary Schweitzer, you are an example of everything that's right in healthcare journalism. So thanks for teaching us each week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
I look forward to it. Thanks.
Gary Schweitzer is founder and publisher of the website healthnewsreview.org. It's Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. If you've ever received a bill or three from a medical visit or procedure, you're often left wondering what all the mysterious-sounding charges are. Why, for example, when you visit the emergency room, is there a hospital bill and a physician's bill? Heaven forbid you've seen a bill for a hospitalization. These can run pages long and bill for everything from IV tubing to aspirin. And why is that aspirin $10 a pill? Elizabeth Rosenthal, a doctor by training, is now a journalist for the New York Times. Her series, Paying Till It Hurts, is must reading for anyone who wants to better understand how our healthcare system works or doesn't work in this country. Elizabeth Rosenthal, welcome to Medical Matters.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to start really basic, and for those that haven't seen your series, how much does healthcare cost us in the United States, and what does that figure actually mean?
Well, the figure that's always given is 2.7, when I started the series, now $2.8 trillion a year. And when you look at that, of course, it's far more than any other country spends per capita. And what does it mean? It means that at some level, we're not getting what we pay for. We pay a lot more, and our results tend to be about the same, if not a little worse, than other developed countries. So that's why I started the series. I wanted to find out, as a physician and as a patient, why we were paying so much, not for the $500,000 cancer drugs, although I think that's a big issue too, but even for the common procedures, the common medical encounters that we've all had, and we open the explanation of benefits or the bills in the privacy of our living room or our kitchen and think, wow, you know, $10,000 for that, that seems crazy. So my goal in the series is to look at ordinary encounters and try and trace the money to see why it adds up to so much.
What are the main drivers of that exorbitant cost? In other words, is it, you know, the amount of money doctors make? Is it hospital care? Is it the expensive medications we pay for in the United States? I mean, how does it rank in terms of what's the most costly items?
Well, I think my answer is always all of the above, and patient expectations too. And that's been part of the problem in solving it, of course, is that, you know, the hospitals say it's not us, it's the insurers. The insurers say, don't look at us, it's these doctors. And patients are kind of in the middle of this maelstrom at the moment. And I think the thing is, yes, we pay more for hospital stays. Our per-day hospital costs are 2, 3, 4 times what they are in other countries. We pay more for the exact same medicines. We pay more for our doctor's visits. We get more doctor's visits. We get more scans, and we pay more for scans. It's kind of everything.
It's just like a fantasy world or something, right, where it costs. I mean, if you went to Canada, for example, and you got the exact same service or services and scans and medicines, first of all, you probably wouldn't pay anything out of your pocket, or if you did, it'd be very little, and the overall charge, the bill, would be vastly less.
Right, that's true. And one thing that we, you know, the services are generally the same in other countries as in the U.S. One thing we have far more of than most other countries is, of course, administrative costs. There was a new study out in Health Affairs showing that we spend something like 28% of our healthcare costs go for insurance administration at hospitals. And when you think of all the money, not the time, that ordinary patients like you and me and our well, you in your case, patients, I don't have them anymore, spend just troubleshooting insurance claims, it's not even valued when we say we spend $2.8 trillion. I mean, there are people I've spoken to in the course of this series who are, you know, high-powered lawyers who take off 5 days of work to troubleshoot pretty simple hospital bills. So, you know, the administrative costs are certainly pretty unique to our system. And then everything else is just we do things in a more expensive way and we do more of it.
So I wanted to follow up on that because I've heard that thrown around, too, that For one thing, that we spend vastly more on administrative costs than any of the other comparable developed, say, Western nations that seem to certainly spend a lot less and get similar or even better outcomes than we do. So one question is, you know, what is administrative cost? I mean, why is it so much in the U.S., and what does it actually mean?
Well, it means, you know, it's obvious at some level that a national health system has lower administrative costs because you have one payer, you know, you have set prices. There's not a lot of the negotiation that's so typical of every step of our system that goes on in those countries. But what you find is that even countries that have fee-for-service systems tend to spend far less on administrative costs. And in our country, it's really because every bill, and we've all seen this, is negotiated endlessly because there's not one bill. You go into an emergency room and there are four bills, you know, from the ER doctor, from the ER, from the radiologist, from the lab, and each of those requires a separate negotiation. And of course, we all have different insurance plans, and even if you and I both have United Health Plan, the terms of those plans is completely different. So the amount of time and effort and personnel that are spent in troubleshooting every step of that negotiation is really pretty mind-boggling. I think one of the most disturbing statistics in some ways that I encountered in the course of this series was that between a patient who needs an artificial hip and the producer of that hip, there are 13 steps of purchasing involved and negotiation involved. And that's just such an incredibly inefficient way to do things. You know, there's the hospital who buys the hip from the manufacturer, but it doesn't buy that hip directly. It goes through a joint broker, which is kind of this extra step that doesn't exist anywhere else. Then meanwhile, your surgeon picks the kind of joint you get, but you don't know, is your insurance paying full price for that joint? What's the hospital markup? There are just so many intermediary steps. Whereas in one of the articles, I compared a joint replacement here to one in Belgium, where the Belgian government just says, okay, this is what we're paying for this joint, and the hospitals can order it. So it just does away with 10 steps of that negotiation. I mean, our system is so inherently inefficient, and P.S., that's kind of part of the problem, because it's a huge employer. Inefficiency is pretty good for jobs, unfortunately.
So I was staggered by that 13 middlemen between. So it's not just like a hospital says, okay, Stryker, or that's just the name of one of the companies, we're going to buy this kind of hip and stock them on the shelf. No, in fact, as you point out, the surgeon, him or herself, will use the broker. And I mean, who knew that there were such things as joint brokers?
Right.
So there are these middlemen that, you know, and at each step, there's a markup.
And the hospital may well employ, and this is another position I didn't even know existed, the hospital may well employ a service to negotiate better prices of the artificial joints, and that person will speak to a joint broker. And it's just these endless middlemen involved in this process that could be so much more streamlined. And, of course, when you say, well, why does an artificial joint cost $20,000, often more than that, on a hospital bill in the U.S., whereas it would be billed at, you know, a few thousand in another country, part of that answer is the endless complexity of our purchasing system, and part of it is, of course, also that we do not have any form of price controls, which most other countries do have.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. We're speaking today with Elizabeth Rosenthal, a reporter for The New York Times, who has done a year-long series on the costs of healthcare in the United States. And we're talking currently about one piece in the series where you compared how much a hip replacement would cost in the United States versus, in the case you wrote about, Belgium. Elizabeth, why are there no generic hips or knees? You know, for example, if I take a cholesterol drug, there used to be Lipitor, and now I can get generic atorvastatin, which is a much lower price. That's
right.
Not true for knees or hips.
Well, it's a little hard to see why it doesn't exist, why no one would jump into the market. But what I've been told is because, you know, these are basically devices that are made of metal and plastic, ceramic. They are complicated, but not that complicated. But the market is really dominated by a few very, very large producers. And, of course, the surgeons have extreme brand loyalty to one of those producers. There are five producers globally of brand name hip and knee replacements. three of them are in a little town called Warsaw, Indiana, where everyone knows each other. So there's not a lot of incentive in Warsaw, Indiana, to try and undercut your neighbor's price. Everyone is kind of working together on this, though not by definition colluding. But those five manufacturers have incredible power in the market, partly because these are surgeon discretion items. So what happens is all of these five companies, they really want to get into the ORs of orthopedic training programs, because there they develop what ends up being a fairly lifelong relationship with an emerging orthopedic surgeon. A surgeon gets to know how to put in, I'm really good at putting in Stryker devices. I know how they work. I've worked with their toolkit before. Most orthopedists have an ongoing relationship with a rep from one of those companies, and a rep from one of those companies is actually in the operating room, a technician, to help put in the joint. So say I want to make a generic joint. It's really, really hard to break into that market because you have to cut through all the old loyalties that exist and all the old comfort that we know as physicians exists when you're using a piece of equipment or a technology that you've become familiar with over the years. So it takes a lot to break down that. You need something really disruptive.
That's a great example of, I think, how the relationships are so important. And as you point out, how imperative it is for whether it's the manufacturers or the pharmaceutical firms to have those relationships with people early on in their training to kind of cement those relationships. So going on with the orthopedic issue, one thing you taught me about in the piece was about a need specially designed for women, and I was intrigued by that idea. It seems like a pretty good idea, actually.
Yeah, it is, although partly what's happened, we're one of two countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceutical products, and that goes for devices as well. So we have a lot of device advertising, and it's not clear. I mean, a female knee replacement, obviously, there are many companies that make devices of many different sizes that are better or worse for different patients. But a company basically can rebrand that device with an advertising campaign that says, as this company did in the, you know, AARP magazine, oh, you're thinking of a knee replacement? Get the female knee. Now, that would be fine if, you know, in terms of the economics of it, that would be fine if it was kind of the same price as the other knee, because really we know the difference in that knee is just the sizing. But in fact, once you brand something the female knee and give it a kind of fun name, the charges get much, much higher. It's not just a knee that's tailored to, you know, the biodynamics of women, but it's a knee that becomes a kind of luxury brand item, and that's where the problem comes in.
So you're really saying that the knee for women is all about marketing, not so much about the biomechanics.
Well, it is different, but other companies make knees that biomechanically are better for women than other joint replacements. But one company had the idea of, we can market it and brand it in this way. And I don't want to demean artificial knees, which I probably sound like I'm doing, but it's not so different when, you know, when food companies decide to repackage. You know, I always think of Lunchables. You put some bologna and crackers in a box and say, this is something new and different. Well, yes and no.
Packaging, yes. All right, I want to finish this knee and hip thing, because that piece in the series also focused on a particularly interesting issue that I think is only growing in importance, and that is the idea of medical tourism.
Yep.
So you write beautifully about the subject of the story, whose name escapes me at the moment, but who went, he decided after pricing things out, he found out that going to Europe, going to Belgium, and having this a la carte hip replacement that included, you know, not only the operation, but the hospitalization and the rehabilitation, he saved a significant amount of money. Now, he was going to Western Europe, but you also touch on the fact that it seems like more and more people are considering, and this patient that you wrote about ruled it out, but that some people will go to India or Thailand, you know, more in the developing world, some folks to Mexico versus Europe. What were some of the considerations for folks in this medical tourism trade? I mean, it's clearly about price, but I think these other nations certainly want to say it's about service and quality as well.
Yes, I think, you know, Michael Chopin, who was the character in that story, he was the best medical consumer ever. I don't know if you remember, but he tried to price out his hip replacement in the U.S., and I want to make sure everyone understands he had insurance. You know, the people in this series are not people who didn't have insurance. He had insurance, but because hip arthritis was considered a pre-existing condition, it wouldn't cover a hip replacement. So he had to go out and price it. And he went so far as to find someone who knew someone at Stryker who could get him a wholesale device. And he decided, after doing a lot of research, that he just couldn't afford it in the U.S. and that he would go overseas. And as you mentioned, he didn't want to go to the developing world. So he did a lot of research about countries and hospitals that have good outcomes and ended up at this hospital in Belgium. So, you know, yes, he could have gotten it even cheaper if he'd been willing to go to the developing world. And there are, of course, issues with quality that people will bring up, and people are not going happily, generally, to the developing world or overseas. They would prefer to stay at home, but the price difference is just so astronomical and so compelling that the choice isn't getting it done at home or getting it done overseas. It's getting it done or not getting it done at all. You know, and there are increasing number of companies that will cater to this need. As someone pointed out to me, you can do this within the United States as well. I mean, there are certain parts of our country that are much cheaper for medical care. Someone joked with me that the best way for the New York Times to save on its health insurance costs would be to put patients in limos and drive them up to Buffalo, where health care costs are a fraction of what they are in New York City. So, you know, this will happen both domestically and internationally. But at some level, too, it's a sad commentary on how we are pricing medical care and how we are pricing even well-insured people out of our system.
So is anyone really doing that yet, taking the limo to Buffalo for their elective surgery?
Not that I've heard of, but there are services in the U.S. And again, I look at them with a mix of admiration and thinking, wow, that's kind of sad. There's one service called Medibid that if you have an elective procedure you need done, you can go on their website and you can look at where you can get it done cheaply. Doctors from different parts of the country will say, you know, I'm willing to do this colonoscopy for $X thousand or $X hundred for a colonoscopy or this hip replacement for $X thousand. So, yeah, you can get some good deals that way. And, you know, I continue to say that I think most hospitals in the U.S. give really good medical care, so it's not that important where you get your colonoscopy. And certainly if one costs $500 and the other one costs $10,000, I don't think there's a 20-fold difference. So we are seeing more of that market-based approach emerge, but it's pretty hard, you know, especially if you've got an older person to say, okay, you know, you need a hip replacement, fly 1,000 miles away to get it because it's going to cost you 1/5 the price there. I don't know that that's really where we want to go.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Elizabeth Rosenthal, a reporter for the New York Times. Her series, Paying Till It Hurts, is about the enormous costs of care we face in the United States for medical care. You're writing about insured patients, so that it's different than say, the uninsured patient who's paying typically the rack rate or getting charged right. The rack rate. So even for routine care that's typically recommended, you wrote in, I think, one of the very first articles in the series about the price of a colonoscopy. So one question I had is, you know, and I think you alluded to this, why do we default to that test? Because in general, it's a more expensive test. But I think what you found is that the price of it is vastly different across the country.
Yeah, the pricing varies tremendously. I think the highest price paid for a colonoscopy in Baltimore was $1,900, which is high anyway, but the highest price in New York was about $9,000, which is what my insurer paid for mine, actually. So, you know, I think the cost is highly variable, and we do tend to default to the more expensive options. And what you see in the U.S. is that, and I heard many complaints from doctors about this, you see your patients getting more colonoscopies than are even recommended. And age groups where you really wouldn't, you know, I heard from a lot of geriatricians who were very upset that their 90-year-old nursing home patients were being told they needed a screening colonoscopy. I mean, that doesn't make sense. More of the elderly, weak people will end up injuring themselves with that, you know, the night before prep running to the bathroom than they will be helped by having a screening colonoscopy. But the financial incentives are all to say, do more, do more, do more. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't tons of honest physicians out there who don't do this. But what it does mean is that those physicians who want to be entrepreneurial or who have, you know, a business consultant who comes in and says, how can I make my practice earn more money? There are answers that are really good from an economic point of view, but not really good when you're talking about what's best for healthcare.
One of the issues that came up in the discussion on colonoscopies was, well, two particular things. One was the concept of a facility fee, and I wonder if you could help us understand what the heck that is.
Well, I always try to compare what I'm looking at in the series with how it's done in other countries. And when I called a couple of people who did colonoscopy and the big colonoscopy experts in Germany and Austria and said, well, what's the facility fee? There was this silence at the other end of the phone, like, what do you mean facility fee? You can't do a colonoscopy without a facility fee. So this has evolved as over the last maybe 10 years in the United States as a big moneymaker. Medicare, and all of these things grow out of good intentions. The concept of a facility fee is to pay the physician or the provider for the cost of maintaining the facility. And obviously a hospital has a lot of maintenance costs that aren't really taken in when you just get a straight physician fee or a straight payment. So the facility fees are different, whether it's in a doctor's office where you don't get a facility fee, whether it's in a surgery center where you get a smaller facility fee, or in a hospital where you get a larger facility fee. And again, a well-meaning effort to compensate different providers for their different expenses. But again, if you want to be entrepreneurial about it, what do? You say, well, I'm not going to do colonoscopies in my office anymore because I can't charge a facility fee. So you and your partners open up, you know, an outpatient surgery center where you get the facility fee for colonoscopies. Or you, if you want to be really entrepreneurial about it, and we see this as hospital and physician groups are consolidating, they say, oh, you know, come do your colonoscopies in our hospital. And then you get the hospital facility fee. So if you want to maximize your income, you move everything to the more expensive place to do it, which is exactly the opposite of what we want. And I know Medicare and a number of healthcare researchers now are talking about reverting to a facility-neutral payments, which I think, you know, we're likely to see in the coming years. And to me, the greatest irony of this is when I started practicing medicine, all the outpatient surgery centers were in their infancy, and the whole point of outpatient surgery centers was that they were lower cost than hospitals. So you could do all these wonderful things like arthroscopies that previously would have had to have been done in a hospital with an admission on an outpatient basis, which is great, and it's lower cost. But now what we've seen is kind of that good intention being perverted to move things that could have been done in office into a surgery center where it becomes more expensive.
As long as we're talking about outpatient surgical centers, I have to ask you about Joan Rivers, who, I guess, unfortunately met her demise in one in Manhattan.
Yep.
Do you see any change that will come in terms of regulating outpatient surgical centers in the wake of what happened to Joan Rivers?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty intensely regulated, which is partly why the costs go up a lot, because to operate an outpatient surgery center, you know, you have to get there's a lot of licensing involved in most states. And I don't know enough about what was the anesthesia provided there. You know, I do worry a little bit that when people hear about bad outcomes and celebrities like that, the lesson will be, you know, wow, we have to have an anesthesiologist in the room every time a sedation is given, which, of course, again, will be a big driver of healthcare costs in our country. The trend has been to use anesthesiologists or nurse anesthetists for things like colonoscopies to give propofol. In many other countries, the physicians give the propofol, the gastroenterologists give the propofol themselves. So, you know, it's really hard to say from one high-profile case what went wrong there. The first lesson I draw, not knowing the details, is you always want to avoid surgery you don't really need.
Yeah. Do we know what she was having done?
No. I think they said something on her vocal cords, but you know, I think all of us who've trained as physicians have respect for surgery, and, you know, it's great when you need it. And if you don't need it, we all have seen cases where things didn't go as planned, even when everyone did the best they could. So I think we have to wait for more information on that case to know what lessons to draw from it.
This is Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. We're talking today with Elizabeth Rosenthal, a reporter for The New York Times, who's done a wonderful series titled Paying Till It Hurts, a multi-part series on the cost of healthcare in the United States. And one of the multimedia features that you have in the series, which was in a story on medication and how, you know, how basically how much more expensive medications are in the United States than elsewhere, was a tool through which you could click on it and see what $250 of certain medications would get you in the U.S. versus many different other countries in the world. How did you come up with that idea? Or who was there a graphic?
It's my favorite graphic in the history of the New York Times, I have to say. It's a wonderful multimedia graphic. And my concern is that no one would read the story. They would all be sitting there playing with that graphic. Basically, we had some data about comparative manufacturers' recommended prices in different countries for different drugs. And we wanted to figure out a kind of compelling way to use that because everyone has heard, oh, drugs are more expensive in the U.S. than they are elsewhere. I think we often like to say, oh, well, that's because they have socialized health care, people don't pay for it. And this chart is partly wonderful just because those prices are manufacturers' recommended prices. So it's not even accounting for what a person actually pays out of pocket. And basically, since the story focused on asthma treatment, we decided to look at first a couple of the asthma meds, particularly Advair, which is hugely expensive in the United States. And one patient told me he financed his, this is really a first world problem, he financed his Paris vacations each summer by buying 7 Advairs for what it would cost him to buy one in the United States. So that became the seed of this graphic. And you can see that $250 goes a lot farther, sometimes 8,000 times farther in buying different drugs overseas than in the United States. And of course, you know, a number of patients have started to, out of necessity and out of the desire to save money, exploit that difference by ordering drugs from overseas. And the FDA doesn't like that. It is in a legal gray area. And, you know, we will see over the coming months some tests of that.
One of the other things that is so great about the series in the multimedia fashion is you have thought-provoking questions that accompany each story. And so you break it down by patients themselves who often will write comments on the stories, uninsured people who write their own, you know, share their own stories essentially of how they deal with this cost conundrum, and then, you know, medical professionals too. And I certainly, as a doctor, I loved looking through the way doctors, in a sense, game the system to what I would call the moral good, which is they're trying to either help themselves or their families because they have a deeper understanding of the system, or certainly trying to help their patients get around some of these exorbitant costs for medications. The answers were pretty savvy.
Yeah, you know, we added that category of provider after the first few stories when we realized we were getting a lot of really interesting comments from physicians and other kinds of providers about the dilemmas they were seeing in their practice and ways they'd kind of come up with to help their patients. Also, a lot of frustration. One thing that's been interesting about this series is every patient in the series is someone who commented on an earlier article. They've all come in through social media, and many of the physicians as well. So, you know, I guess what's striking to me, and when I talk to physician groups, I emphasize this, you know, there are a lot of physicians who are very unhappy with how this system is working for them and for their patients. Because, of course, when your patient goes for a MRI and discovers it's, you know, $3,000, and oh, guess what, the radiologist is out of network, your patient comes back to you in frustration and says, hey, doc, you know, why did you send me there? So I think there's a certain alliance between particularly the primary care doctors and the patients that we will see growing and perhaps producing some change.
So you, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that essentially subsequent stories in the series came via social media or via commenters
yep.
to some of the original stories. Tell us what you did in order to kind of potentiate interest in the series.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I hope everyone joined in. We decided after many months of the series, there was an incredible, you know, we've had 10,000 plus comments to the first installment and many tens of thousands more in the course of the series. And it was really clear that people wanted to talk about this, but there isn't a really good forum to talk about it. So we decided to start a Facebook group where people can join and share experiences, share solutions, share interesting articles. And we've only started it about 2 months ago. It's really, really been fascinating to me because I learn things from. I post things there most days, and I also learn from our contributors who range from physicians to patients to advocates to insurance execs. You know, the thing that's striking to me is no one, I think, really likes the system the way it is, and everyone has different ideas about how to change it. So it's been really fascinating. I urge everyone who's interested in this topic, and particularly those who are obsessed with it, like me, to join our Pain Till It Hurts Facebook group. It's a great place to share ideas.
And unlike the New York Times paywall, it's absolutely free. All you have to give Facebook your email address. And
yes, absolutely. And the whole series actually is outside the paywall, I believe. We took it outside the paywall earlier this year.
Oh, excellent. That's very good to know.
I believe the Pain Till It Hurts series, you can go look at all those great multimedia interactive graphics that the graphics team developed. They're all outside the paywall. I also urge people, this is one thing we haven't talked about, to take the, we developed this online quiz called Is This a Hospital or a Hotel? Where you can take a test where you see pictures of, I think, 12 different hospitals or hotels, and you have to guess. And partly I wanted to make the point about hospital overbuilding in this country and what patients expect, because patients often see themselves as victims of this system, which they are to a large degree, but also they help perpetuate it because, you know, patients in the U.S. now want to see private rooms. They want to see, you know, Starbucks in the lobby. And our hospitals have come to look more like five-star hotels, and I can tell you that does affect our bills.
Amenities. We all want amenities.
Yes.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Elizabeth Rosenthal, who actually started life as a physician and is now a reporter full-time for the New York Times, has put together a magnificent series, multimedia series in the Times called Paying Till It Hurts, about the costs of care in the United States. I wanted to tackle one more area, which you touch on in one of the pieces, about nonprofit hospitals. The vast majority of hospitals in the U.S. are still nonprofit. And an issue that's come up, I would say, politically is that a lot of people feel like, given the sort of enormous costs in healthcare and the enormous revenues, I guess you could say, that a lot of these nonprofit hospitals make, that there are some lawmakers and politicians who want essentially to strip hospitals of their tax-exempt status, arguing essentially they don't provide enough community benefit. What did your research and reporting tell you about this aspect?
Well, it's a very, very complicated area. It will, again, as we struggle to deal with this issue of healthcare costs, we really need to define better what we expect out of our not-for-profits. You know, when you think of the number of cities in the U.S. where the biggest employer is the medical center, when you think of how many medical centers are doing things now that don't really benefit their immediate community, they're opening hospitals in China or opening clinics in Dubai, they have all sorts of side ventures. So should they be paying payroll taxes? Should they be paying property taxes? I think a lot of cities that are, you know, still reeling from the financial crisis are looking at these fancy new buildings and saying, hey, wait a second, it seems like you have the money to pay taxes, and it's not clear, maybe some of what you do is good for our community, but it doesn't seem you're very mission-driven anymore. So I think we're going to be seeing some reevaluating of that, but also, of course, hospitals are powerful political players in most cities. I think I read something that they are the major employer now in something like a third of U.S. cities. So, you know, they have a lot of clout to keep their tax-exempt status. And I don't know that there's a right or a wrong answer, and some hospitals clearly are much more committed to serving their community than others. But I know there are a lot of people out there who think we need to rethink this whole idea of tax exemption for hospitals. And often when I say that, people will say, and yes, and some of the universities too. So I think, you know, it's a broader question than just hospitals.
In that story, you used the lens of an emergency room visit to California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, and the data showed that they're, in fact, the most profitable, if you will, of the nonprofit, of any of the hospitals in California. And I was just wondering, because it was a pretty hard-hitting expose, in a sense, was there any kind of reaction from California Pacific to your story?
Well, I admire them because they stepped up to the plate. They granted me an interview with their president, who, or their CEO, Dr. Browner, who basically said, look, we've got a lot of overhead. We've got a lot of expenses. Our patients expect this. And you know what? Sometimes when we charge, you know, $150,000 for a hospital stay, we have a cash-paying person who can afford it. So why shouldn't we try, was kind of the attitude. And I think, you know, I admire them for saying it. I ended up at California Pacific Medical Center because we got two complaints from their emergency room. So it was an obvious place to go. And also because California, to its credit, requires hospitals to file their charge masters with the state. So I could actually see at California Pacific Medical Center how they were calculating their bills. So, you know, they were at some level unlucky that I ended up in their lobby, because there are hospitals all across the country doing the same thing with even less transparency, so I couldn't really dig into their practices as much. But, you know, it is true, some of these nonprofit hospitals are among the most profitable endeavors, and certainly the most profitable nonprofits in the country. If you look at the top paid nonprofit executive in every state, it's almost always a hospital executive. So, you know, I was in Arkansas doing another story. The head of the Clinton Foundation in Arkansas makes a small fraction of what hospital presidents make in that state. So I think we really have to make sure we get what we're paying for and make sure they deserve the tax breaks they get, because being a not-for-profit hospital means only that there are no shareholders. It doesn't mean that they can't have a positive operating budget, which many, many of them do. And all it means is that they plow that back into the organization. Now, they may plow it back into good things, or, you know, healthcare things like building a clinic in an underserved neighborhood, but they can also plow it back into art for the lobby and, you know, high executive compensation, which I think most of us would say that's not what we want our nonprofits to be focusing on.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is our guest. She's a reporter for the New York Times. The name of the series is Paying Till It Hurts. And it is now available online in front of the New York Times paywall. And if you're interested in further information, you can look at the Facebook group, Paying Till It Hurts. You can just check that out there. Elizabeth Rosenthal, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is a reporter for the New York Times. Her series on the cost of healthcare, Paying Till It Hurts, is available free online at the New York Times website. This is Medical Matters. For comments or questions about the show, this week or anytime, email me at schumann.john@gmail.com. That's Schumann with two N's. Writer Sherry Yerkowitz graduated from Harvard Medical School last spring. She beautifully captured the essence of what it's like to experience being a medical student in her blog, This May Hurt a Bit, on the Scientific American Blog Network. This essay, her most popular, is titled Post-op Check.
It's okay that you don't remember me. My name is Shara, and I'm part of the surgical team. I'm checking to see how you're doing after your surgery. Do you know where you are right now? Actually, you're in the hospital. You had surgery a few hours ago, for a broken hip. You used to be able to walk before you broke it, so it was important to fix it as soon as it was safe to. We're not sure how you broke it either. You said you couldn't remember falling, or even having much pain. Your daughter noticed swelling in your leg a few days ago and brought you here. She went home for a bit, but she's been here with you the past few days. We waited a few days before the surgery to make sure you were medically ready. You had some fluid in your lungs when you first arrived, so we gave you medications to help get rid of it. It probably wasn't related to what you ate or drank. You were eating a lot, though. You're the only person I've ever seen with a broken hip with that good of an appetite. Do you remember the last thing you ate before your surgery? It was a big chocolate chip cookie. I was there during the surgery. I'm still a student, so I didn't do much. But you can learn a lot from watching. Thank you for letting me watch. I was there when they wheeled you into the room. Your surgical cap was too big for you, and it kept falling off. We asked you your name, and you said it. All three names. We didn't even ask you for the middle one, because we didn't know you had one. We then put you to sleep. You took deep breaths through an oxygen mask before we turned off your consciousness and paralyzed your body. I held your hand as you closed your eyes. The nurse whispered to you that everything would be okay. We fixed the bone. It took a few hours, because your bone is fragile. There was bleeding, but that's normal. Bone bleeds a lot. We gave you blood and fluids to replace what you lost. Did you know that many surgeons play music during operations? It was going so smoothly that we were humming along to Who Says You Can't Go Home. It was during the bridge of the song that your blood pressure suddenly dropped. The anesthesiologist called it out. I looked at the monitor and saw numbers flashing in red. There was a lot of red, actually. Blood in the wound, blood in the suction container, blood in transfusion bags, bloody footprints on the floor. No more than with any other patient. But I think somewhere along the way, I learned to take the sight of liters of blood for granted. I was scared. I stopped watching them stitch and stared at the monitor, which suddenly seemed like my closest connection to you. They called out the medications they were giving you to raise your blood pressure. After a few minutes, it worked. Your blood pressure slowly climbed to green numbers. I was still shaking as I silently willed the numbers to stop bouncing around. But the numbers stubbornly drifted down, even though they were keeping up with the fluids, even though you were on medications that force your blood vessels to clamp down and your heart to beat harder. The red returned and was unrelenting. Your blood pressure was too low, your heart rate too high, the tracing of your heart rhythm irregular and non-shockable. We can be done in 10 minutes, the surgeon said. I've never seen surgeons work so fast. They're usually so particular about their stitches, getting the perfect angle and length for each one. I've also never seen so many anesthesiologists at the head of an operating table. I've never seen an ICU bed booked so quickly. I've never seen someone lose their carotid pulse. Apparently, it's rare to die on the operating table. They almost always get you to the ICU first. Twice in 8 years, said the anesthesiologist. Once in 15 years, said the surgeon. Once in 80 years for you. I couldn't bring myself to touch your hand again. I watched, though. I watched as the room slowly cleared, and people tried to figure out what to write and who to call. I watched as they kept your eyes shut and handled your body just as gently as they had a few hours ago. I listened to the final zip of the body bag. I don't know who had the time to switch off the radio, but I'm glad they did. I listened as the nurse asked God to rest your soul. I watched you leave in a different kind of bed, to a different place. I'm not sure where. You can learn a lot from watching. Thank you for letting me watch. We fixed your hip, sir.
Shara Yerkowitz recently graduated from Harvard Medical School. She's an editorial intern at MedPage Today. This essay first appeared on her blog, This May Hurt a Bit, and went viral when it was featured on the NPR blog, Krulwich Wonders. Medical Matters is produced at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. Scott Gregory produced and edited today's show. Music for the show is created by Scott Griffith. Our theme music is by Europa 51. I'm John Schumann. Join us next week for another edition of Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition.